Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how superfans gained the power to run the show. We'll spend this hour with writer Michael Shulman, who traces the history of fandom, starting with the Latin term for temple servants, on up through Beatlemania. And the Beehive. Let's go get 'em. Today, Shulman says, ardent admirers have so much power to make or break a superhero sequel or TV season that some creative teams are starting to take their wishes under advisement when planning what will happen to beloved characters. We'll talk about how that works and whether it's good or bad for the final product. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Game of Thrones was not the sort of show people just casually watch. Detail-oriented and highly opinionated.
They just spent tons of money to have a CGI dragon destroy King's Landing, but didn't let him pet his dire wolf before he left Winterfell. Come on!
The whole thing about the dire wolves is that they couldn't show them that much because it cost so much. And here you have a dragon basically burning down the entire city for the whole...
After the season finale, some fans demanded a do-over of the entire final season. They never expected their beloved Daenerys to become a bloodthirsty mad queen. And after all, what was the show for if not to please its fans? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So far, it doesn't look like HBO has plans to indulge Game of Thrones fans, but the visibility and power of fans has grown in the digital era, when devotees of TV shows, movies, and comic books can come together by the thousands at conventions and online. And online, they can not only spell out what they hope will happen, but write and share alternate storylines and endings. Professional writers, directors, and producers are starting to pay attention. But is this how art is supposed to work? Writer Michael Shulman is a contributor at The New Yorker magazine. His article, Superfans, A Love Story, appears in the print issue under the headline, The Force is with Them. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
How long have fans existed in our culture? How long have they been a thing?
Well, the actual word fan bubbled up around the end of the 19th century. It was originally used to talk about sports fans. Professional sports leagues were becoming a more popular thing. And so there was suddenly this new class of people who would go and watch sports but not necessarily play sports. And obviously they were very impassioned and they would have allegiance to their teams. And so newspaper writers started using the word fan to describe those people. But the behavior of fans precedes the actual word. There are a number of prominent examples from the 19th century, like listomania, which is people who went to concerts to see Franz Liszt play the piano would fight each other over his broken piano strings and locks of hair. And that was kind of like the proto Beatlemania or Biebermania. You had Sir Arthur Conan Doyle who tried to kill off Sherlock Holmes because he was sick of writing Sherlock Holmes stories. And his readers just rebelled. They started a letter writing campaign. They started canceling their subscriptions to the magazine that the story ran in. And he eventually had to bring back the character. So that's a bit of a forerunner to the TV fans we have today fans of serial novels who try to take an active part in, pushing for their favorite characters, pushing for certain romantic relationships, turning against the creators, trying to voice their opinion.
The derivation of the word fan actually comes from fanatic, right? It seems like really kind of a perfect word.
Right. Yes. And the root of fanatic is the word fanaticus from the Latin, which referred to people who are of the temple. From ancient Rome. So it has these kind of religious roots.
You start this piece with a cautionary tale. Woe to the writer who offends superfans. How did Juana Thompson, this freelance music writer, get Nicki Minaj people on her case?
Right. So Juana Thompson is a young freelance music journalist. She lives in Toronto. And last summer, she was listening to some new Nicki Minaj music, and she tweeted something like, you know, I wish Nikki would write more mature music. She's touching 40. A new direction is needed. You know, so not a hater comment. It's basically a kind of mild criticism. And she put her phone away. She went to see a show, a podcast. And then 2 hours later, she looks at her phone again. And according to her, hundreds, if not thousands, of Nicki Minaj superfans were just attacking her, sending her direct messages. Somehow Nicki Minaj caught wind of this, and she herself was DMing Juana with this kind of insane rant, which she later denied she even sent, although it came from her official Twitter account. You know, superfans were, you know, hacking her website and spreading around her phone number and making sort of hateful photoshops of her 4-year-old daughter. She then got fired from her internship for this whole other assortment of reasons, because she was working for this hip-hop blog that was run by someone who was also doing marketing strategy for Nicki Minaj. So it just upended this woman's life within a day. And the irony of it is that she had been a Nicki Minaj fan.
Minaj launched what's called a clapback. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so clapback. There's a lot of you know, kind of internet lingo that's sort of popped up around fandom, but just, you know, in general, clapback is basically talking back to a hater or a dissenter. So if someone insults you, even if you're a big star and they're a lowly, you know, whoever on Twitter, you clap back at them.
So a clapback is a call to arms for Minaj's stans to follow suit. So what is the difference between a fan and a stan?
So a fan is a stan is essentially a kind of turbocharged fan. The word comes from an Eminem song from 2000 called Stan, where Eminem imagines a fan named Stan who's writing him letters. The Stan gets really upset that Eminem isn't writing him back, and he eventually drives off a cliff with his pregnant girlfriend in the trunk. And it's short for stalker fan. So it has a very dark origin, that word. But over the decade or two since the song, it went through the hip hop community and then kind of surfaced as this social media catch all term just for a really ardent fan or someone who, especially in pop music, kind of has brought their fandom of someone or something into their online identity.
So from the view of celebrity culture, does a stable of stans signify that someone has really hit the big time?
Yeah, although there are stans of pretty much everything now. You know, if something has a fandom, as it's called, you know, then the sort of upper crust of it is going to be a stan. And I think part of it is just that the idea of being a fan is so widespread and so endemic to mainstream culture that stan is a way of almost sort of distinguishing yourself as a sort of special aficionado. Although in certain cases, stans feel that it's their duty to retaliate or go on the attack or become more aggressive. And that is something that has resulted in these stories like you hear about Juana Thompson, where the stans kind of find each other online, create a community. And then if someone questions or critiques the thing that they're a stan of, they can sort of swarm that person.
So you found that fandom of the past was a subculture reserved mostly for the very young or the very obsessed. How did fan culture go mainstream in the 21st century?
Well, I think there are a couple of causes. One of them is obviously the rise of the internet and social media. So, you know, in the 1960s, for instance, if you were a Star Trek fan, you might go to seek out a convention, be part of a letter writing campaign to keep the show on the air. So you would see people in person and kind of gather in these sort of physical places. But the internet made communities so much easier to form. And, you know, social media has intensified that, made it sort of just instantaneous that people can coalesce around a certain thing. I think also part of it is that culture itself has changed. You know, if you look at Hollywood right now, it's so franchise driven, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Star Wars and Game of Thrones, you know, there are so many kind of epic fantastical or sci-fi serial narratives. Harry Potter is another another big fandom. So in that sense, you know, geek culture or nerd culture, as it used to be, you know, it has just is just everything now. You know, there's no sort of separate, you know, underclass of nerds who are into their own weird sci-fi thing. You know, everyone's into, everyone knows this, you know, Game of Thrones now. Everyone knows Star Wars and Star Trek, and it's not a sort of weird subculture anymore as much.
Occasionally, aspects of it are disturbing. You found that some fans really seem to take exception to updates and remakes of movies that once featured all white casts when they now include characters of color.
Yeah, I mean, that can really work both ways. You know, one of the examples I use is Star Trek The Last Jedi, which came out 2 years ago and featured a lot more. I think there was a conscious effort to feature more women, more people of color. You had the Kelly Marie Tran character. And there was a movement of Star Wars fans who attacked her online. And it had there was a real kind of racist, sexist element to it. They actually bullied Kelly Marie Tran off of social media. She got so much cyber harassment. But I think the drive itself to make Star Wars more integrated, you could see as bubbling up from, you know, fan pressure. You know, one example I didn't get to put in the piece is that the Harry Potter Broadway show features a black actress playing Hermione, and it's been suggested that that idea bubbled up from fan art and fan fiction, and that the Harry Potter fan community, there was an element of it that love to imagine Hermione as a person of color, and that eventually kind of found its way into what you might call canon through this Broadway show.
So this could all just amount to a lot of noise, often fun noise online, but producers are starting to pay attention. Fans forced a 3-month delay in the release of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yes. So Sonic the Hedgehog is a movie that's coming out next year. It's a mix of live action and CGI. If people aren't familiar with Sonic the Hedgehog, he was a Sega character from the 90s. I remember playing the Sonic the Hedgehog video games. This is a movie about Sonic. And when the trailer dropped in the spring, the internet just caused a commotion over the fact that the hedgehog CGI character had these creepy human teeth. He had a full set of teeth, not like, you know, little sharp hedgehog teeth. And there was something about it that was so kind of uncanny valley and disturbing and just a little off. This was before the Cats trailer had a very similar reaction. But what's interesting about the Sonic the Hedgehog example is that after all of this, the movie studio, Paramount, actually decided to go back and redesign the main character and push the release date 3 months, which, as you can imagine, is a huge use of resources of both time and money being put into this to essentially incorporate fan feedback.
Wow. So what do his teeth look like now? Do we know?
We don't know yet. I tried to find out, but, you know, people in Hollywood, you know, treat these kinds of, you know, things like state secrets.
Yeah, I went down a rabbit hole or a hedgehog hole before the show Googling this, and I thought my IT team must think I'm wasting a lot of time before the show looking this up, but I wanted to see what they look like. I didn't think the human teeth looked so bad.
You know what's interesting is that there was a lot, when the trailer came out, there was a lot of fan art on Twitter where people reimagined Sonic the Hedgehog as they basically improved on the movie design. So you see there the kind of the power of the sort of homegrown fan imaginative art, whether it's art or fan fiction or, you know, cosplay, stuff like that. All these sort of vernacular ways of fans expressing themselves that are, you know, they are real sources of creativity.
My guest is Michael Shulman. He is a contributor to The New Yorker magazine. He's got a piece called Superfans, A Love Story.
having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, you know, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you, people? I mean, for crying out loud, it's just a TV show. I mean, look at you. Look at the way you're dressed. You've turned an enjoyable little job that I did as a lark for a few years into a colossal waste of time. I mean, how old are you people? What have you done with yourself?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boy. That was a clip from a 1986 SNL sketch featuring William Shatner talking to Star Trek fans, ostensibly at a Star Trek convention. My guest this hour is New Yorker magazine contributor Michael Shulman, whose article is called Superfans, A Love Story in the hard copy edition. It's called The Force is With Them. We can't talk about fan culture without talking about Star Trek fans, can we, Michael?
No, that's certainly true.
So they like to be called not Trekkies, but Trekkers. How did Trekkies fall out of favor?
Oh, gosh. The way it was described to me by Henry Jenkins, who's a Star Trek fan, but more than that, he's an author and academic who has long studied fan behavior, is that back in the sort of 60s, 70s era of early Star Trek fan communities, Trekkies was kind of an internal pejorative term that was used more toward female Star Trek fans to kind of discredit them. So it actually has this kind of backstory as, you know, just an internal, you know, schism within Star Trek fans. And then somehow it just caught on and the whole world started using Trekkies as a pejorative for, you know, nerds who loved Star Trek. So the preferred term in the Star Trek fan community is Trekkers.
So what was it about this 3-year sci-fi series on TV in the 1960s with, frankly, pretty bad special effects that inspired such rabid devotion?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, many things. That, you know, I think part of it is that, like other sci-fi and fantasy stories that, you know, inspire big fandoms, it kind of created this big universe that you could just sort of jump into. It was so progressive and forward thinking. You know, there was a lot of racial diversity on the show. There was an interracial kiss. There was so much about science. So I think that people gravitated to it as almost its own kind of secular value system. And then, you know, and then it was canceled. It was almost canceled when it was barely on the air. It wasn't a huge hit. And so the fans came together and did a letter writing campaign to the network that saved the show really only up until the third season. And then it was finally canceled for real. But that was enough that it had been on the air enough to have a certain number of episodes so that it could go into syndication. And once it was in syndication, you know, it just was on TV perpetually, and that's how the fan community could grow throughout the 70s. And they started, you know, it was basically this, you know, this huge David and Goliath win. And so the fans were so excited, they started having conventions. You know, they had formed a community through this letter writing campaign. And the first major Star Trek convention was in 1972 in New York City, and they gathered under this banner that said, Star Trek lives. So I think part of why it inspired this fervor is because it needed the fervor to stay on the air.
So Henry Jenkins, this Trekker who was also a fandom scholar, says a lot of people misunderstand the nature of fandom. He sees it as a source of being creative for people who would otherwise not have a role in making content.
Absolutely. You know, so Henry Jenkins wrote a book in 1992 called Textual Poachers, which was kind of, it was one of the founding books of a field called fan studies, which is now, you know, a very big, diverse, complex academic field that studies all kinds of fan behaviors. You know, I couldn't begin to summarize what they're working on because it's a pretty large field now. And fan studies, you can take fan studies classes in some colleges. And there are many scholars kind of looking at what it means to be participatory in our culture now and you know, and how fan communities behave. But one of the things that Henry Jenkins wanted to say in this book, and it was partly inspired by that William Shatner SNL clip where he says, "Get a life," is that, you know, fans were being stereotyped as either, you know, dweebs in their parents' basements watching Star Trek who sort of buy every Star Trek memorabilia item, you know, kind of without any discrimination, just these kind of blind consumers, or the kind of Beatlemania stereotype of the screaming teenage girl, you know, throwing their panties on stage or whatever. And he really wanted to counteract those stereotypes, which I think by this point are much less prominent. You know, I think people have gotten the message that, you know, being a fan of something, being a hardcore fan, even a sci-fi fan, you know, it doesn't make you this or that. But what he saw is that there were, you know, these networks of people pre-internet or very early internet, this is the early 90s, who were forming communities. You know, he visited a group of women who were writing Quantum Leap fan fiction. People who were fans of the X-Files were gathering together and forming theories, or, you know, writing fan fiction about Mulder and Scully. And so, you know, he wanted to give credit to the power of expression and creativity that these fan communities were finding.
For some super fans, this thing in their lives has filled the role that religion once would have filled.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that. And I just want to be clear that there's nothing wrong with being a fan. You know, I still think despite what the work that Henry Jenkins did, which laid the groundwork for you know, serious fan studies throughout the decades, you know, people still do have make, you know, sort of broad generalizations about fans. When as deranged fanatics who, you know, and there are elements of that. Certainly, especially on social media, you see people being much more aggressive and antagonistic. And part of that is because social media in general is more aggressive and antagonistic these days. But, you know, so much of being a fan, you know, pretty much everyone's a fan of something. I mean, I can tell you what I'm a fan of. You know, I'm a fan of Broadway musicals. I'm a fan of, you know, Succession. Like, it's normal to love works of art, to love a movie, love a television show, a movie star, a musician. You know, this is, it just means that you love some creative product, which is totally fine. But I think, you know, what it gives to some people, what fandom gives some people is a kind of organizing principle in their lives that, you know, maybe religion might have otherwise had.
All right, I want to go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. First calling is Anne in Austin, Texas. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is going to date me a little bit, but we had just moved to California in 77 and trying to get jobs, and we had an empty afternoon, and we went to see a movie we heard nothing about, which was Wednesday or Thursday afternoon, which was Star Wars. And by Saturday night, buildings had, you know, lines around the block and so on. Of course, way pre-internet. I'm just wondering your thoughts on the phenomenon of that. There have been very little pre-publicity or trailers out, and how something could go from that to this, you know, incredible turnout in fans that started that weekend.
Thanks for calling.
Right. I mean, Star Wars in 1977 was, you know, beyond gigantic. I think it's hard for me to say why is Star Wars such a huge hit. I think part of the reason is that it was escapism, maybe at a moment in the country where a lot of things were feeling very frayed and fraught and divided. You know, as I was saying before about Star Trek, it's kind of a big fantasy universe that you can use your imagination to fill in the gaps of. That's why there are so many people who are, you know, theorizing about who Rey's parents are, what's going to happen with Rey and Kylo Ren in the next episode. I mean, people love to sort of, if a work of art kind of captures people's imaginations, there's this bottomless well of what fans can bring to it. And I think that helps make something popular. You know, Star Wars is also very different than a lot of what had come before it in movies. You know, if the movies of the 70s were so, you know, there was this auteurist, gritty, realist cinema, and Star Wars kind of came along, and it was this pop escapism that, you know, that just sort of, you know, literally brought, you know, showed people a different galaxy. And, you know, it's, you know, for after a decade or so of, you know, like Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, that was a huge change, you know. And it kind of took a cue from Jaws a few years earlier, which was also just a gigantic sweeping popular phenomenon.
It is possible, if unlikely, to turn fandom into a career. Tell us about Steve Sansweet.
Oh, yes. Steve Sansweet is possibly the biggest Star Wars fan in the universe, in the galaxy, in our galaxy.
Okay.
I can't speak for
Yeah, you got to be careful here.
So he's someone I sought him out, and I met him in person when I went to Comic-Con. Started out as a Wall Street Journal writer. At least he was a Wall Street Journal reporter in the 70s when he went and saw a preview screening of Star Wars before it even came out. And he was so enthralled with it that he started a collection of memorabilia that has now grown into the biggest Star Wars memorabilia collection in the world. And that is certified by Guinness World Records. And he eventually housed them all in a museum in Petaluma, California that he calls Rancho Obi-Wan. So you can actually go and buy a ticket and see, you know, all of his cavernous, you know, his stuff, that he, caverns of things, of Star Wars things. And that's everything from an official, you know, Darth Vader mask that was used in one of the movies to fan art. He said one of the things he has is a portrait, a fan portrait of Princess Leia made of buttons.
Huh.
Sadly, I haven't gone there yet, but I would really love to go. And another, so one thing that's interesting about Steve Sansweet is that he was not only just a huge fan, but he eventually was hired by Lucasfilm in the 90s to be their fan ambassador because they were trying to build up the fandom as they were starting to roll out the prequels. And so his job in Lucasfilm was to travel to conventions, to sort of oversee fan images being distributed to fan magazines. And he would sort of talk about, within Lucasfilms, he would talk about what fans wanted, how to reach them. So he became this kind of liaison.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So you mentioned fan fiction a few minutes ago, Michael. And of course, it's not surprising that people can sort of write these alt stories for their favorite characters and turn them into erotica because they'll do that with almost anything. But there are a bunch of interesting subgenres. What is curtain fic?
Oh, I was so happy to learn about curtain fic. So curtain fic is basically fan fiction about characters just doing ordinary domestic activities, like, you know, I guess curtain comes from if they went curtain shopping.
So if like Spock if you are and Kirk just, go curtain shopping.
Yeah, if like Spock and Kirk or, you know, Sherlock and Watson, you know, going appliance shopping or, you know, going to the grocery store. You just want to, it's this kind of soothing version of fanfic where you're actually just imagining offhand ordinary moments of their lives.
Is any fan fiction actually good writing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in fact, there was a huge milestone just recently. The website, An Archive of Our Own, which is a gigantic fan fiction website, won a Hugo Award, which is the it's the science fiction award. It's like the Oscars or the Pulitzers of science fiction. And the website, you know, and all its contributors won a Hugo Award this year, which was a gigantic milestone. Another one is there was a Twilight fan fiction writer who changed the names of her Twilight fan fiction and turned it into something called 50 Shades of Grey. So the whole 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon has its root in fan fiction.
What's so interesting about that is the Twilight series is viewed by a lot of people to be sort of a metaphor for teenagers sort of fighting against their sexual impulses, and clearly that's not happening in 50 Shades of Grey.
Right.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer Michael Shulman about his New Yorker magazine piece, Superfans, A Love Story. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. Before the break, Michael, we heard from Jennifer, who met some fans at BronyCon, who were adults, even though this is about My Little Pony. Some of them seemed really talented, but maybe hadn't quite launched independent lives. So is fandom potentially something that could stunt people's professional development?
Well, first of all, I don't know if she was saying that they hadn't launched their own lives. I mean, I think what she was talking about was the real care and creativity that went into this one brony person's YouTube channel, which, I think is great. You know, I mean, why not? Social media of all kinds has allowed people to have platforms to express themselves. And I think for a lot of people, fandoms, they're almost like prompts that, you know, allow you to figure out what to express, what to talk about, where to put your imagination. I'm not a child psychologist, so I can't really speak to the health, the developmental benefits or lack thereof of fandom. But I will say that I can anecdotally tell you it makes total sense to me that adolescents would be fervent fans. I mean, because we feel everything so deeply in adolescence. That's why Romeo and Juliet are, the symbol of passion. You know, I think when people are teenagers or young adolescents, you know, you're starting to really feel these complex adult feelings, but you don't necessarily have an outlet for them. Everything in your world feels bigger than it actually is. And so why not get drawn into something like, Star Wars to sort of, or whatever, Twilight, just as an outlet, because that's how big your emotional world feels. And you haven't quite formed all the aspects of your identity yet. In the piece, I talk about my own history of fandom, because I felt like, you know, it would be only fair for me to kind of come out as a fan. And the one that I remember most strongly is when I was a teenager in the 90s, being a super fan of must-see TV Thursdays on NBC with Friends, Seinfeld, and ER. Hmm. And one of the things I would do is at some point in 10th grade, I had a T-shirt for each of those three shows. And on Friday morning, I would go to school in the shirt of whatever show I thought had been best the night before. So if I thought Friends had the best episode of Friends, Seinfeld, and ER, I would come in to school with my Central Perk T-shirt, which is so, like,
that's adorable.
In retrospect, I can't believe it's in the New Yorker of all places. But but when I think about myself in that period, you know, I was very secure in that aspect of my identity and very proud of it, and much more so than other parts of who I was that I hadn't quite figured out yet. Mm. The other thing I just want to mention, because someone on Twitter mentioned it, and I think it's a really good point, when I was talking about the term clapback earlier, I should have mentioned that it has its origins in Black culture. And Stan as well is something that, you know, even though it came from Eminem, it morphed in the Black hip hop community into what it is now, which is a much more positive, widespread term. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that.
Go next on the phone to Cheryl in Eustis, Texas. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi there.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I'm an older American, and my father worked for NASA from the very beginning. And I know that a lot of the people that I grew up with were huge Star Trek fans, and then, I don't know, maybe later on Star Wars fans and all the other ones. And do you think that maybe us growing up watching the space program made us think that perhaps we have a lot more things going on now than we do?
Like the flying car phenomenon. Do you think maybe it was some fandom born out of hope that this sort of thing could happen?
Absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, and Star Trek started in the kind of mid-60s and, you know, went right up through the moon landing. So I think there was this kind of utopian feeling about what might happen And that there was this sense of possibility, absolutely.
It is pretty amazing to be a fan and meet another fan, especially if you're into something that doesn't seem to be everywhere in the culture.
Yeah. So of the people I talked to at Comic-Con, I talked to a lot of fans over the summer. It basically boiled down to two things, identity and community. So I think those are the main two things that people get out of fandom. They have some kind of organizing principle for who they are, and they also have a community of people who they can talk with on a very granular, detailed level about the thing they're a fan of, whether it's, you know, the technology on Star Trek or, you know, the lineage of the characters on Game of Thrones. And there were all these fan theories that bubbled up over the years.
So
absolutely.
Comic-Con, you write, started in 1970 with just a couple hundred people.
Yes. And it was mostly about comic books, which almost isn't now.
So it's hard to find the comic book section of Comic-Con in 2019.
You can find it. There's plenty of it. It's just, it's so funny. You know, I had never been to it before. I've been to other conventions, but this is my first time at Comic-Con International in San Diego this summer. And you walk in, and first of all, it's overwhelming on every conceivable level. It's just so many people and so many costumes, which are so detailed and great. But then there are these gigantic build-outs for, you know, Marvel and Star Wars and, you know, everything. Like, you know, SpongeBob SquarePants, you know, just so movie over the years, movie studios and franchises and television networks have come into Comic-Con and use them as major marketing opportunities. So it now just feels like this gigantic city almost. And you do, if you walk down, you come to the comic book sort of trading booths, which are kind of like, as I said in the piece, they're like, they feel like a rent-controlled section of a gentrified city. You know, it's just like they've just been overwhelmed. It's like this tiny little house that with, you know, sky rises all around it.
So when we think about fans now feeling as if they should have some say in plot details, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but it made me think about whether we also, now that we, you know, treat politics like a form of entertainment, is fandom giving us the sense that we ought to be able to say yes to the plots that we like in real life and call the other ones fake?
Oh, that's a really interesting parallel. I hadn't thought about it that way. I mean, I think for television in particular, and my colleague at The New Yorker, Emily Nussbaum, writes a lot about this. She's the TV critic there. Fan culture is so prominent around television, first of all, because there's so much television now and people are talking about it all the time. But also because it's serial storytelling, you know, fans can actually change the course of events, whether it's trying to save a show that's going off the air, like, you know, Arrested Development, or, you know, I mean, there are a million examples of that. And sometimes it works, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, or whether it's, you know, expressing their displeasure at the way the story is going, you know, like Game of Thrones or, you know, Lost was a big one. There were these two annoying characters on Lost named Nikki and Paolo who were introduced in the middle of the show. Mm-hmm. Fans hated them, so the creators just had them get buried alive like two episodes later. So fans do exert a certain influence on serial television shows. And now that movies are becoming more about serial franchises, this same dynamic is starting to become more at work in movies as well. As for politics, you know, it's really complicated. I think on some level, politics and fandom have always overlapped because, you know, politicians have followers. They have devoted audiences who, you know, feel very strongly about them. They're cults of personality, good ones and bad ones. But I do think there's some weird overlaps now that we're seeing more and more. The New York Times had an article about this just recently. It came out a few days after mine about how there are more and more memes and kind of fanish activity around presidential candidates and people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, you know, you just see more sort of little gifs and stuff that are made of presidential candidates and sort of fetishizing things about them or, you know, relating them to pop culture. So I think it's a really interesting development. I'm not quite sure where it's headed. I think, you know, the political sort of divisions in the country have a lot of different reasons, and I wouldn't put it all on fan culture or television watching. It's kind of its own bag, but I do think there's some interesting overlaps.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's go next on the phone to Chad in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Chad.
Howdy. I had a recent experience. My boyfriend, who is substantially younger than I am, and I went to an anime con in San Antonio a few weeks ago, and he mentioned how really neat it was that everyone was walking around being as authentic to themselves as they chose to be, without, you know, any fear of judgment or shaming or anything like that. And I'm curious to hear what your guest might have to say on that particular observation.
What a cool take. Thanks for calling, Chad.
That is absolutely the feeling that I got from Comic-Con, is that people were really felt like they were showing so much of their true selves, that they were showing that they had this sort of means of expression through creative costumes, that, you know, they didn't have in other, you know, realms of their life. You know, this one woman I talked to who was dressed as a Marvel character said that she had worked in a financial firm for a really long time, an investment bank or something. And she just and cosplay, or, you know, which means costumes, you know, creating your costume, going to conventions and costumes, was kind of her outlet. And at first she hid it from her coworkers, but eventually it became something they knew about her and you know, liked about her. It was not something that ostracized her from her coworkers, but it gave her a kind of creative outlet and a way of feeling like she was being herself in a way that she wasn't being herself as a you know, person in a cubicle in a financial firm. So I think that's absolutely true. And I also want to mention, because the caller talked about his boyfriend, that so much of fan culture has been really progressive in terms of queer identity. You know, a lot of the, you know, for instance, you see you know, a ton of fan fiction about same-sex couples, whether it's Kirk and Spock or Watson and Sherlock are two big ones, or, you know, people who write fan fiction about Piper and Alex on Orange is the New Black. You know, there's so much sort of historically, there's been so much kind of queer wish fulfillment, or, you know, seeing you know, homoerotic subtexts in stories and kind of writing them into stories, I think has been a great outlet for people who haven't had that in their own communities.
How much thought did you put into what you would wear to Comic-Con to go there as a journalist?
I mean, I didn't dress up. But no, I didn't even try. I mean, I couldn't compete with these people. People had put so much effort into their costumes, and they were ones that really made me laugh. My favorite ones were this one couple came as extras from the Hitchcock movie, The Birds, and they basically had these 1950s sort of normal townspeople outfits, but then they had glued these like birds to themselves attacking them, and they would just pose for pictures where they would just start, you know, I can't really recreate on the radio, but they would sort of freeze in a screaming position, and it looked like birds were attacking them, but because they had birds attached to their clothes. It was fantastic.
Did you feel strangely conspicuous not wearing a costume of some kind?
No, there were plenty of people there who don't wear costumes. It's not everyone. But there are, I mean, and some people just buy, you know, a Halloween mask, a Spider-Man mask, and do that. But, you know, on the other end of it, there are people who really put so much effort into it.
Is there equal room for men and women in fandom? The whole Gamergate thing made a lot of women feel like they were not welcome.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a bit of a different question, which is there equal room for men and women in gaming culture, which I think is changing. You know, I think it's been particularly male dominated, and that's why Gamergate is a whole rabbit hole that we don't need to go down. But in terms of fandom is very female, And, you know, it's one of the misconceptions that people have about fan cultures. You know, even starting with Star Trek, you know, Star Trek culture was incredibly diverse and very female-oriented.
Writer Michael Shulman.
Yeah, I think there's plenty.
Michael Shulman is a contributor to The New Yorker magazine. His article, Superfans, A Love Story, that's the online title, appears in the print issue under the headline, The Force is With Them. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. And thanks to all the callers. They were great.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We do hope you'll subscribe to the Think podcast and check out our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.